Relay FM. This is Downstream, a podcast about the present and future of streaming media. This is episode number 65, recorded March 28th, 2023. I'm your master of ceremonies, Jason Snell, and with me, as always, Julia Alexander, our director of strategy. Hi, Julia.
Jason, I'm so sorry. It has taken us so long to record this episode.
Yeah, we're a little so late. Sorry. And it happens. You had some travel, and Julia, everybody, dear listeners, sent me a screenshot of her calendar, and it was the most frightening. It's like, I know you like horror movies, Julia, but your calendar is a horror movie.
Every week I have meetings that overlap with meetings, and I make like a last minute gut decision. I'm like, I'll go to this meeting, I guess.
It's really amazing and terrifying. It's also, we tried to record yesterday, and I wasn't feeling very well. People are getting a much better podcast today anyway. So you were triple scheduled. I didn't feel great. And I was like, let's just bump it. But this one's going to be great. It is. It's going to be great. I promise everybody. Disney. We're going to start with Disney. It's the happiest place on earth. The wonderful world of Disney.
I'm wearing a Mickey Mouse shirt as we record
this.
Perfect.
It's perfect. Actually, two of our biggest topics will be a good fit for what you're wearing and what I'm wearing. So we'll get to it's a baseball opening day, so we'll have a sports corner in a little bit.
Yeah.
But first, Disney, four finalists for the CEO job, Dana Walden and Alan Bergman, who are the entertainment co-chairs, Jimmy Pitaro, who runs ESPN, mm-hmm. and Josh D'Amaro, who runs Parks. And Lucas Shaw had a really good piece on Bloomberg about this. And I want to know what you think about the current state of Disney succession. But I wanted to put Lucas's comment out there because it's so smart. And adding it to the discussion, I think, is so important, which is no one is ready to be the next CEO of Disney. Nobody can really be ready. You have to look for somebody who can learn and grow on the job. But you can't discount somebody just because they haven't done the job of being CEO of Disney. It's not possible. And then he also mentions, and I know you've talked about this too, like Netflix has two CEOs, right? So there's also the question of, do you even need to pick just one? Do you want to build a structure where because you don't want to lose three out of the four of these executives either, because these are all very talented people. So what do you think about the current state of affairs, assuming that Bob Iger will eventually have to leave eventually, in a couple of years, maybe?
I think... So similar to Lucas, and something that we've talked about on this podcast, is this idea that a multifunctional singular CEO existing at a company like Disney, which is going through its biggest pivotal transformational moment in decades, does not make any sense.
Yeah.
And so if I look at Netflix, like I think the promotion of Greg Peters to co-CEO alongside Ted Sarandos after Reed Hastings kind of took a step back, but said two things. One, it said to the company, to the people that were working at Netflix, that we care just as much about the technology that and design that underpins our direct-to-consumer streaming product, our app, as we do the entertainment that Ted and Bella's teams work with to really produce what people come in for. And the other part of that is that it also signals to Wall Street, and remember, these are all publicly traded companies that we're talking about. They have a fiduciary to their shareholders. It signals to Wall Street, we are placing just as much importance on the future of our technology development, our ability to do significant A/B testing, our ability to create personalized recommendations, new innovation across gaming, short form content, whatever it might be, as we are on the content itself. And therefore, if you're in Disney's position, if you're, you know, Bob Iger's position, the board position, they have a very important proxy fight happening right now, the vote next week, that could potentially change the board, the makeup of the board.
Right.
If we look at Disney is not going to be a technology company. It doesn't necessarily want to. Like, it didn't make an effort to buy like an EA Games. Like, it didn't make an effort to buy Epic Games, although it invested in Epic. And so the question to me is, what is Disney's future as a business? And I think if you look at the next 10 to 15 years, the obvious standout is content and parks. And the question for me then is, okay, on the park side, you have Josh D'Amaro, and you can't have a singular park CEO come in because you just had a park CEO come in and it went really, really bad. And it was Bob Chapek. But if you had a Dana Walden type, as opposed to Jimmy Pitaro. I'll get to that in a second. If you have a Dana Walden who's got the relationships with Hollywood, right? She's like godmother to Ryan, or I think like Ryan Murphy is like godfather to her kids. Like, if you have the relationship with Hollywood, if you are seen as a center for creativity that creators still want to come and work with, then you have your John Landgraf, right? You have all these people. I forget the guy who's heading up the general film team now for Disney, but he came from Searchlight, right? Which really speaks to kind of this creative factor. If you have someone like Dana partnered with someone like DeMauro, who again is in charge of parks, I really think that signals to the street, here's where we're putting our investment. It's why we're spending $60 billion over the next 10 years. It's why we're doing XYZ. But also, we are a direct-to-consumer company, and we understand that there's content there, and we want to make sure that we have a DeMauro in charge with someone like a Dana. Now, the two people who aren't being brought into this conversation, one is Jimmy Pitaro, who is the head of ESPN, and arguably Disney makes a lot of money on sports. The other one is Aaron LaBerge. Aaron LaBerge is the CTO, and so he does a lot of the technology on the streaming side. And the question I have is, if you're going to be a streaming-focused company, is it crucial to have someone like an Aaron LaBerge kind of sitting within that top position? But I don't think that sends the right signal to Wall Street nor to creatives. At that point, you're saying, we're kind of like Netflix, we're kind of like Amazon, we're kind of like Apple. And Disney's biggest advantage is that they're not Netflix, and they're not Apple, and they're not Amazon. Now, the street wants to see Disney reach those profit margins. They want to see Disney reach $500, $600 stock, because that's what happens with Apple and Amazon and Netflix. And that is just not where this company is going to be. This company could be a $150, $200 stock. And I think you get there by really creating a strong flywheel effect that they've had for a while, which they kind of lost sight of, which is content brings people to parks. Parks brings people to merch. Merch brings people back to the content. And in order to do that, you really need to have those co-CEOs working together. And that's where I come in. I think there's no way in which a singular CEO makes sense at Disney. And Pitaro, the one I forgot to just mention really quickly, so he's head of ESPN. I think you can have him sit within or under Dana. I think at some point, sports becomes a form of content that sits within DTC. And that kind of sits under this person who is in charge of content in general. There are people who might disagree with me on that, but I just don't think he's a strong enough contender for what the Disney vision is compared to a Dana with a DeMauro. But I'm interested in your take on it.
Well, Pitaro, I am really intrigued by Pitaro because he has done very well at Disney and running ESPN. And ESPN is in a real moment here, as we've detailed in numerous Sports Corner segments, where they take so much money from the cable bundle, but that is about to end. Mm-hmm. And they're building a new place for it to go, whether it's Hulu or its own over-the-top thing, and then also any other direct-to-consumer kind of content it wants to do. And as an aggregator, we'll talk about that a little bit more in Sports Corner. So I think he's in an interesting place where he's got a huge task ahead of him, but success in that task could be really beneficial to him. I also kind of look at that job and say, ESPN, especially if they get outside investors in it, you know, I think that it might end up becoming a little bit more of a dotted line where Jimmy Pitaro is the CEO of ESPN, and that's a CEO job, and he's got a lot of bosses, including Disney and the NFL and maybe the NBA or somebody like that, and that's the job. I'm not sure running Disney is a thing that makes as much sense, although I will say, if in the next couple of years Jimmy Pitaro manages to bring ESPN out of the woods, that's a real feather in his cap, whether he stays at Disney or goes somewhere else or expands ESPN's charter even further. I don't know what the path is for him. So he strikes me as being in a really interesting position. But, you know, I'm with you, I think, in thinking that in the long run, you know, just having one person say they just are in charge of everything and they know everything, and not having a kind of a more Netflix-like kind of multiple roles that interact with each other. And yeah, if there's one CEO or they're co-CEOs, if you try to think of it in a, you know, structurally, Disney is so huge and requires so many different talents that what you really want to do is, how do we keep as many of the talents who are aspiring for greater things as we possibly can? And Disney is such a special company. It's one of the entertainment giants. That I think the last thing, you have the ability of keeping somebody as not the big boss who's 100% of the boss. Because even if they went somewhere else to be the big boss, there are very few places they could go that would be as big and challenging as being a number two at Disney, honestly. And if you want to be a number one, you can go somewhere else, but you're going to be going into a smaller pond potentially. So I think the parks thing, parks is such a specialized thing that I am deeply skeptical of somebody from parks running Disney, because I just don't think it's the same business. I think it's just such a different business in so many ways from the rest of their business.
But see, the only pushback I have on that is that that parks is still the vast majority of its revenue. It's like that in media networks. And if media networks goes away, right, which is effectively the cable bundle, if that goes away, which we know, I don't think it's going to go away as fast as we've been declaring, what, Jason, for the last 20 years that cable's dying, right? I think linear as a whole probably has more years than we suspect it will. But at some point, it gets to a point where, you know, the OPEX of running something like that and the CAPEX of providing for something like that is no longer in line with the profit margin you get from it. But parks, here's the other thing about parks
for people who are wondering, I'll break it down. Revenue-wise, parks is a third of Disney's revenue. Yes. Linear networks are a third of Disney's revenue. Direct-to-consumer is 20%, and sales and licensing and other is 11%. But in terms of operating income, in terms of where they make their money, two-thirds of it is parks and experiences and products, and one-third of it is linear, and that's it.
And that's perfect. Thank you, by the way, for breaking that down. And so the other thing that I think is missing from this, so we look at like how parks, what Jason just said, right? Parks does well for Disney. Therefore, that's why you can see why they're saying we're going to put $60 billion into the parks over the next 10 years. The other aspect of this, though, which really plays into this kind of more macro theory that I have about consumerism in general over the next 10 years, is that inherently, physical experiences become more valuable for two reasons. One, they're scarcer by nature, right? So a big Taylor Swift concert, a football game, a trip to Disney World. They are scarcer. Two, they create really strong memories, and we don't actually have a lot of opportunity to do that as we lose a lot of access to events in our own communities. But three, the form of passive entertainment, so kind of what you watch via streaming, or even to an extent theatricality, although that's closer to like an event as we consider it, that is so passive and there's so much of it, we're oversaturated with it, that we don't really have any form of adoration for it. Now, we have adoration for like brands, right? So we like the new Star Wars, we like the new Star Trek, but we don't necessarily look at TV as a whole and we're like, oh, this really jazzes us up. Now, we watch it, we like it, but when you compare that to the experience that you get of going somewhere, there's two things that happen. One, there's more serotonin, although it is more expensive, and that's a huge issue, right? We all can all acknowledge this. Going to Disney World, especially as a family, not cheap. But so there's more serotonin associated. And two, and this is my big theory, kind of at a macro level of consumerism, the aspect of an event has gone from we to me. And what I mean by that is the incentive structure for getting someone out to somewhere, whether it is a movie, whether it is a theme park, whether it is a sports game, is the ability for that person to take that moment, which is transient by nature, right? It's ephemeral, and then put it onto social where there's a longer tail. It is the I factor in doing something, because if I go here, I'm showcasing my fandom, which is my identity. Identity leads to acceptance within communities online, and acceptance within communities is built on persistence, right? So the ability to continue posting. So the ability to say like, oh, I love Taylor Swift, I'm tweeting about Taylor, this is great, has some form of value, but being able to go to a concert and record a TikTok and put on Instagram and showcase that you were there adds this other level of value. And I think those worlds are going to collide much, much, much more as your social value becomes tied to your in real life value, in terms of like, I get a lot of experience or joy, job offers, I meet friends, I meet potential relationship partners on the internet through this kind of identity in the form of fandom. And I think Disney understands two aspects of this. One, that they need to make their parks feel a little bit more like video games because that's what people are doing and they want to go out and have really great video game experiences. I went to Disney World for the first time recently and I did the Avatar ride at Pandora, which is like a giant IMAX screen and kind of like cool VR. It's wild, right? Like it's a $500 million, I think, like ride. It's incredible. And so I think they have that aspect of like the rides need to get better. We have to do these really cool immersive experiences that people want to go do, but also we need to create almost Instagrammable opportunities. And you know how you can see this happening with sports. You can see different teams at different cities building like these, what they call like sports centers, right? They're like, there's a bar and there's all these things. You come and you hang out before you go into the stadium and we're going to do Instagrammable moments. And like, it's all these aspects of come and have this moment that creates memory, that's really fun, that you're willing to spend money on. We have all this data that showcases that people, especially Gen Z, are much more likely to spend money on experience than physical good. And so the ability of being like, I would rather go spend this money, go here and do this thing, get photos, whatever. And then we also know that that adoration for those moments bleeds back into the content, right? It's why you have like the Disney adults who love the content and they go to the park, they love the parks. And I think that will become much more persistent. So for Disney, while DTC is incredibly important in supporting that, I actually think the parks is where the largest form of their fan building and their differentiator is going to come in. And I think it's why you see that investment. And I think elevating someone like DeMauro to CEO or co-CEO really reiterates. Now, I think to Jason's point, I realize I'm rambling about like macro consumer theories, but like to Jason's point, you cannot have DeMauro by himself because the other big factor, and especially for Wall Street, is like, what's your streaming strategy, especially when you're not profitable? Like, what do you do there? And that's where I think having a Dana or a Pitaro really speaks to like, okay, we know what we have to do. And the really difficult thing, and I'll Jason, I want to get your thoughts on this. It is extremely difficult to create good things. Like it's just hard. It's why the yes. average film model used to be like you make 10 movies, one hopefully does well, nine or not. And yeah. Disney is at a point where like they're kind of stressing and I'd be like in a bad way, they're putting stress on their core legacy to the brands to the point that the consumers are like, I don't know if this is actually helping my sentiment toward it. But if you look at Netflix, and this is why I think this is really important, Netflix licenses content from all these guys, right? To ensure that their churn rate, which sits at about 2%, according to Antenna, it's really, really low. It's the lowest of them all in the United States. To keep their churn rate low, which means that the value of the product from consumers is really high, which means you have pricing power, right? So you can go in and say, we're going to increase our prices again. We may all complain, but very few of us are going to cancel. As that continues happening, you might cancel, but instead of getting rid of the service, you go to the ad-supported tier, which they want, right? They're like, great, you come back down here. We have a premium version, which will likely include some of live sports going forward, maybe exclusive games, whatever it is. And then you have your ad-supported version, which is the version that even if I think it is what kind of exists now in the ad-free version. I think this ends up being the basic tier. But with Netflix, what's the real big lesson we've had for the last 5 years? It is hard to create content that sticks, right? It is just, it's difficult. So Netflix has not been able to create anything that other than like Stranger Things, Bridgerton, they've not been able to be like, oh, we've got this huge IP. They know this. Disney is now at a point, so is Warner Brothers, so is Paramount, all of them, where they're like, we have to make new things. Like we have to go and make new things. And yeah. especially for Disney and NBC Uni, because they have the park that we can then put into the parks. Like all these aspects combined. And it's really scary if you're like, we can't make good things. This is the number one issue facing Disney right now that no one wants to talk about. They can't make a good movie. It's like, and if you're Disney, that is way more concerning than your inability to maybe bring more people to Disney Plus over the course of the next quarter. Mm-hmm. Because it's one and the same. And you're licensing your content to Netflix. So you're driving an audience towards Netflix to expect value out of them. So this is where I'm like, what are the two core issues facing Disney? And content? Parks.
And the right. And the parks, I mean, parks is not in a vacuum, right? Like one of the reasons, like you could Disneyland, Disney World, all the Disney parks are going to be successful to a certain degree because of the magic that they provide, like in their expertise as being mm-hmm. parks people. But the bottom line is they are products that are built on intellectual property.
Yes.
And you can't pull it apart. the like one of the things. So my last time at Disneyland, I'm a California boy, so I just go to Disneyland. I went to the Star Wars land inside Disneyland, and I went to the Avengers campus at at California Adventure. They have Avengers campus, which is still it's missing a ride because mm-hmm. of the. But because the pandemic and all that, but like they're getting it there. And I thought to myself, you know, I have so many more reasons to come to Disneyland now because of Star Wars and Marvel. And like, it's always there. My in-laws live 15 minutes away from Disneyland. It's always there. But like having a reason and having it be tied to something that I love really helps. And that's why you can't separate them. And you're exactly right. Anytime you've got your intellectual property, sorry, for saying it this way, generation machine, or we could say your creative studio, struggling, then it is going to hit the parks eventually. It may not, maybe not soon, but eventually it's going to hit the parks. In fact, ironically, because they bought Fox, their big generator right now is Avatar, because the Avatar 2 was also a huge hit, and they have park stuff for Avatar, and so that's good, but... So in the end, for me, I think this is almost an unsolvable problem because they already, in some ways, they solved it. They have three groups inside Disney. They have entertainment, they have parks, and they have ESPN. That's the right way to structure that company, I think.
Yeah.
And so all we're really saying is who gets to wear the crown? And I guess what I would say is the person who wears the crown needs to be somebody who delegates lots of authority to the three princes, essentially. I know princes metaphorically. One of them's a princess. But, you know, this is my point, is the CEO needs to be somebody who listens to those three people who are running those divisions and sets some priorities, but is not, like, they don't need to solve all the problems. They need to be a good leader who listens to and works with the people who run the three businesses that drive the company.
Yes. The other
that could be anybody, but it needs to be a good leader. It doesn't, they don't have to be good at X. The X that they have to be good at is leading arbitrating between these three different groups that all need attention. That's it.
Absolutely. No, you're so right. And much, much harder to execute on, right? Especially at that level. And I think what would be really fun is I was just thinking about this while you were talking about kind of this skill set you would need as a leader with all these three princes. I love that. And the interesting thing is, so Iger came into Disney via an acquisition, right? He was at ABC, Capital Cities happens with Disney in the 90s. And so Iger comes in via that route and then ends up becoming CEO of Disney. And the person he then puts into CEO position is Bob Chapek, who came into Disney originally, right? The fun thing to kind of think about, just so you know, one of those, like, if you were reading a novel about it, it would be like a one sentence little throwaway, would be if Dana were to become CEO, she would have been coming to Disney through an acquisition, right? Like, she came in via Fox and then would end up taking over CEO, much in the same way that Bob Iger did, compared to a DeMauro and I believe Pitaro. Bergman, basically, I don't think is going to be anywhere near this, but Pitaro versus DeMauro, who were both Disney people. Like they kind of came up through Disney. And I just think that's kind of fun because Dana, much like Bob, would have this experience with navigating – creating well kind of coming into a new culture, creating a culture within that new culture, and finding the best way to like move forward, versus the other two are kind of like, this is how we've done it, this is just always how it's been. And you have people who have come into Disney in a very large way through acquisitions, whether it is Marvel, Lucasfilm, Fox, like whatever it is. Oh my goodness, who the tech guys, BAMTech, like those, you have all those people coming in a very relatively short time in terms of the timeline of the Disney company, which is 100 years old. We're talking really the last 10, 15 years. And having someone like Dana would almost be easier to navigate those kind of cultural shifts, much like Bob did. But again, that's like a not real thing. It's just like it would be a one sentence throwaway line in a Disney novel about this. But I was like, that's kind of interesting too, is that they've encountered similar. I mean, also, let's be very honest, Dana would be the first female CEO, right, of Disney, which is, you know who I would have picked? And she would never go for it because I think she's got a really great position. She's really happy with it. I think I said this on a podcast once when Jason and I were talking about this months ago. Donna Langley, who's the CEO of NBC Universal. Is she? No. She's the chief content officer. Excuse me. I think she's wow. chief content officer. She, because you know what it is about her? She's proven that she knows how to do IP via acquisition, right? Because they've done like all the Despicable Me stuff is partnership with Illumination. So they have a great relationship there. They've got the Blumhouse relationship. So she's good at making these kind of effective films. The Universal had the largest year last year, just beating out Disney, which is a huge win for them. But she also... she would have experience with Peacock to an extent, but she also has experience with the parks.
See?
And I feel like that's huge because it's like, yeah. right? And Dana versus does not have as much experience because she came in later. But Dawn, I think, has a very good relationship with Brian Roberts, who's the CEO of Comcast. And I think she's in a very good position. She obviously had the best year last year with Oppenheimer, right? That was a huge winning story for Universal. They took this bet on this movie about a guy who made a bomb, right? And which on the if we talk about it now, we're like, that's a great idea for a movie, but really think about that, right? It's like the core of like Jurassic World and Marvel, and he's like, let me tell you about this guy.
It's
like,
an adult movie. It's a movie for adults. It's a drama about a historical figure, not a and yet, I mean, I read a story about this, about how they said, we're going to do it and we're going to pay for it and market it as a blockbuster, even though it's not what we think of as a blockbuster. And you know what? It was a blockbuster and it won Best Picture, too. So, yeah, good job.
So anyways, yeah, I think Succession-wise, my bet is that it ends up going double and it ends up going DeMarro
and Walden.
Yeah. What's your final?
First off, what they really need is a Bob Iger type, somebody who can just be like up top going like, everybody do their thing. But you're right. In the end, Bob Iger is not immortal. He's got to go at some point.
He wants to go sit on his boat. Yeah. It's finally fixed. He wants to go sit on
it. So I think, I mean, not knowing these people and not having worked with these people, I think that the challenge is going to be, step one, you say they're all in, and you want to, as your their mentor, Bob Iger, you're like, I'm going to mentor you about the things that you need in this job as CEO. And then honestly, my feeling is you got to read it based on where you think they can grow as a person, and that it's going to end up being, can Dana Walden grow to understand enough about how to manage the person managing parks that she can keep that into mind? Or can Josh DeMarro grow as a person who can manage the people managing entertainment and be a good CEO that's looking at the big picture? Because nobody knows better than Bob Iger what job it is. I mean, I guess, you know, there are like two other people to be the CEO of Disney and what it takes. And you're trying to make a guess about who has the best makeup, essentially. Yes. the best traits to do a job. As Lucas Shaw said when we started this, no one is going to be ready to be the next CEO of Disney. So what you've got to do is, and it is baseball opening day, I'll say it, you're looking at prospects and you're trying to project. You're trying to say, does this person have what it takes to sit in the chair? And I mean, they have four good candidates, so that's good. So I don't have a prediction because I don't know enough about the psychological makeup as a mentor looking at Dana Walden and Josh DeMarro, for example, or Jimmy Pitaro.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I don't know, but this is why it is the most difficult kind of like hiring thing in all of the entertainment industry right now, is that you got to find somebody.
The other thing, just really quickly, which Jason kind of hinted at, and I don't even know if you knew you hinted at this, but I thought it was great, which is he pointed out that, you know, there's a certain markup you need, or makeup, I should say, for like a CEO type, right? Like there's, and it's really hard to know what that looks like. And I think that's spot on. The other thing to remember in this ordeal is someone can, and we all have, either we've been this person or we've hired this person or we've had coworkers for this person. It's really hard to know that if someone is good for the job or good in the interview, right? There's a lot of people who are great at interviews. Like they just come off fantastic. Mm-hmm. And then when they're in the job, they just cannot do it. And that's And that is in itself, I mean, one, it's a skill for the person who's doing the interview because, like, good for you. But I would argue to an extent that was a Bob Chapek thing.
Yeah.
Where Bob was great at his role in Parks. He probably interviewed super well with the board. And then when he got into this role, it was like a nightmare. Mm. So now the question is, to your point, Jason, I think it's very much who's the makeup of this person and are they going to be okay at the interview but also excel in the role? And I think that's hard to navigate.
I'm going to throw out one other wild possibility. I don't know if this is actually possible, but I'm just going to throw it out there, which is I wonder if this becomes viewed as such a risky thing and also almost an unsolvable problem that they do something like say, okay, here's what's going to happen. Bob's going to be the executive chairman of the board, and we have three CEOs. And then it's literally entertainment, ESPN, and Parks. And like,
honestly, I would. Who tried that?
Someone there's no CEO. That. I mean, if you're going to have two CEOs, why not have three CEOs?
Didn't AT&T try it with Turner? It was like there was a CEO of Turner, yeah. There was a CEO, right?
I don't know. I could see somebody being like, why are we even trying to elevate somebody when we have three divisions that are working really well? And they all need their own work, and they are, but they're talented people running them, and they need to do their jobs. And why do we need to elevate somebody above them? But I think, yeah, I don't envy them, but eventually somebody is going to have to run Disney. Mm-hmm. All right, more Disney to come, but first, before we get there, let me tell you about our sponsor. This episode of Downstream is brought to you by Good Chop. A lot of people are focusing on eating well and having enough energy to do everything you want to do. We're very busy people. We don't have time to run to the butcher or the Whole Foods or whoever to get a quality, fresh cut of meat. Good Chop is a lifesaver. For me, it will be for you in terms of managing what food you have in the house and what you can cook for dinner. Good Chop offers fully customizable boxes of high-quality meat and seafood delivered to your door on your schedule. They are vacuum sealed and frozen at peak freshness. So you stock your freezer with this high quality frozen vacuum sealed packages of meat, and then you thaw them and cook them on your schedule from right out of your freezer. Could not be. My wife and I do meal planning. We're like, well, what are we going to do tonight? And I'm like, well, I'll get something out of the freezer. You can choose from over 70 high quality cuts, 100% grass-fed ribeyes, USDA prime filet mignon, free-range and organic chicken breasts, pork tenderloin, thick-cut bacon, just to name a few, and sustainable and wild-caught seafood, including salmon, Pacific cod, scallops, shrimp, and more. We're just doing our meal planning. It's like, what do you want? We had a bavette steak. I was like, all right, so pro tip, if you have a sous vide machine, and I recommend getting one, they're not that expensive anymore. You can cook things in them, but you can also thaw things very quickly. So you put the Good Chop meat in water with a sous vide cooker that's turned down all the way to nothing, and it just makes the water move around, and it's physics. It thaws it real fast, and then you can just cook it on the grill or do whatever, or season it, put it in a plastic bag, put it back in, bring it up to temperature, put it back in, and cook it sous vide if you want, but I'll also do it on the grill. But it's great. It's so great to just be able to have a library of stuff and not go, oh, we don't have anything in the store. We got to go to the store before we can even cook. It's really changed how we do meal planning. Unlike many other companies, Good Chop sources its meat and seafood exclusively from American farms and fisheries. You can support local family farms and independent ranchers in the U.S., and it doesn't cost a fortune. Price per meal starts at just $3.74. Good Chop especially prides itself on sourcing meat that comes with no antibiotics or added hormones ever. No artificial ingredients, only the good stuff. They're so confident in the quality of their cuts. They offer 100% money-back guarantee. You love Good Chop or you get your money back. That's it. Go to goodchop.com/downstream120 and use downstream120 to get $120 off across your first four boxes. That's goodchop.com/downstream120 and code downstream120 for $120 off. goodchop.com/downstream120, code downstream120. Thank you to Good Chop for supporting this show and all of Relay FM. All right, we have a little bit more about Disney before we move on to our other topics. Just really quick responses from you I wanted about. First off, Taylor Swift, Eras Tour concert debuted. Disney Plus won the auction, basically, to get that. Debuted to 16 million views in the first 3 days, 5 million completed views. I think what people would say are okay numbers, but not the greatest numbers of all time. They're not Hamilton numbers. And again, Hamilton had not, as you pointed out on Twitter, actually, Hamilton, you couldn't see before unless you went to a theater. Eras Tour was in theaters in addition to being in stadiums. You could go see the Eras Tour movie in theaters, so there's a little bit less exclusivity. I'll also point out it's more than 3 hours long, and so having a low completion time, I still haven't watched it, and I really want to watch it because I want to find time to watch it, and I want to sit down and watch it for 3 hours, and I don't three and a half hours. I don't have that kind of time, so I've just sort of I haven't watched it yet, and I'm absolutely going to watch it. So I don't know, but what do you think about this number? It's obviously not huge, not terrible. How do we read it?
So I think, yeah. So first of all, to be blunt, this is a disappointment for Disney, right? Disney obviously went out on a huge marketing spree for this. They did a takeover. They thought this was going to be absolutely big for them. But also, I don't think this is the end of the world for Disney. And there's a lot to consider with the and also, so there's a lot to consider with Taylor, and here's my kind of three quick takeaways. One, these numbers feel much smaller because everything else compared to this tour and this moment for Taylor Swift felt unprecedented, and these numbers were anything but, right? So it was like unprecedented revenue from the tour. It was like an unprecedented amount of fandom for Taylor. It was like the during the Taylor Travis situation. Like all these things were happening, and it made Taylor feel like this newborn god on the planet. And so when they didn't really showcase in these figures, everybody was like, oh, this is like the issue with Disney, right? But what we have to remember is kind of what I was saying about earlier with the way that fandom works today. People went to the concert. That concert, if you were on TikTok or Instagram, you have seen it because it was uploaded. Every song was uploaded as right. People put it on. Then it was made available on VOD. So if you're a big Taylor Swift fan and you couldn't go to the concert, you bought it. You went and you said, I'm going to spend the $20, $25. I'm going to have access to it. Or you pirated it because you're 20 years old, right? Like one of those happened. By the time that it actually comes to Disney Plus, there might be a lot of people. I would put Jason and myself in the situation who were interested in it, not enough to buy it, not enough to go see. Oh, and also it was in theaters. I forgot about that, right? It was in theaters. It made $200 million, I think, $250 million in theaters. That's huge. So you had all these different opportunities to engage with it. That means two things. It means there's not a huge rush opening weekend or that opening week to watch it on Disney Plus, but it also means that there are opportunities for people to come back to this type of programming, right? When she has a new album come out, when something happens and people want to check out the Eras Tour on Disney Plus, you can still only get it there. There was a lot of comparison from before, and you brought up, Jason, I appreciate, to Hamilton. Hamilton, you could only see it, right, as Jason said, on the stage. It hadn't been anywhere. It wasn't even in theaters. It came out in July 2020. It was the July 4th weekend. That was about 5 months into the pandemic.
Yeah.
Less than a year after Disney Plus launched. Everyone is at home. You also have this big moment for Disney where Disney gets to point out not only was Hamilton a really heavily watched title on our platform, but it actually brought in this group of subscribers that we had never seen before, these kind of adult subscribers, right? This is before the Disney streaming services bundle, so before Hulu's attached to it, right? So all these different things have affected how the overall initial engagement with the Taylor Swift documentary might not be as high as people were expecting. Also, although, you know, Disney Plus has, I think it's about 43 million subscribers domestically, you know, that's still about half of what Netflix has. So it's still a huge segment of people who you're not necessarily going to be reaching. I would also argue the makeup of Disney Plus is a little bit more male, skews more male. It's young, but it skews more male versus Netflix and Hulu skew more female. We know who the Taylor Swift audience is. So all of these different aspects lead to, it's impressive that that many people still watched it within the first 3 days. I think it's a good sign that it's not necessarily the worst investment. Did they spend too much money? TBD. We'll have to see how it goes. But it's also, there is this external pressure for this to do really well in general because it was on Disney Plus and because it was streaming and because Taylor had this huge moment. And I think that overshadowed what was realistically going to happen. I had a friend ask me, you know, what do you think it'll do? And I said, I don't know. I was like, maybe Suits numbers, right? I was like, that'd be cool, right? Like, so it worked out Suits was 3 billion minutes viewed. It worked out to be like 50 million views, I think. So I was like, oh, maybe it's around there. And looking back on it, I can see all the reasons for why that wouldn't happen, right? Like how a 3-hour movie feels more daunting than a 9-season show for some reason. I know that, right? It just feels more daunting. And so there's all these different aspects of it. I think it's a lesson. I think there's a level of saturation for concert docs, even if it's Taylor Swift, and especially if you've got 4 different windows before you even get to streaming. But I also think Taylor sits there the way that Beyonce sits there, the way the Beatles sit on Disney Plus. Like there's a level of premium brand associated with the artists that they choose to have on Disney Plus.
Right.
And that are also family friendly. And so I think it's too early to declare it a loss. It's too early to declare it a win, but I think it was disappointing for Disney and not the end of the world.
Right. I think that's fair. All right, another Disney question. This actually comes in the form of a letter. Remember, you can go to downstreamfeedback.com and send us your letters and other stuff. We'll talk about that more at the end. But this is from Sarva, who says, Hi from India. What is your opinion on the Disney-Reliance merger? And more broadly, what do you think Disney's streaming strategy is? Looking at this merger and Spulu, is it just recreating the cable bundle, as that is a more reliable source of income than competing with every other streamer in the market? So this is Disney in India, basically, where they've had a lot of success because when they bought Fox, they got Star. They are actually merging with Reliance Industries, which is a big telecom company in India, and they're putting their stake in with Reliant, and they're a minority shareholder in the new entity. So they're basically, they've sold out. I mean, they still have their thing, but it's inside another thing now. Very big change to their India strategy. What do you think this means, Sarva asks? And I think it's a good question of like, why does Bob Iger do this deal in India?
Well, curious on, because I realize I've been monopolizing the microphone. What are your thoughts on it?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know enough about the India market, but this looks, I think what we've heard is that India is a very difficult market, and that although they had great success in it with the properties that they bought from Fox, a lot of that had to do with things like sports rights. And they lost the sports rights, I believe, is the story there. And so in the end, I think maybe this looks a little more like an ESPN related story than it is a Disney Plus related story. Maybe potentially that they've lost some value there. I don't know. I think if you're Disney and you look at a market like India that is huge and requires for success, it requires some things that are not in your global strategy. It's some very specific things for that market, and they're going to be very expensive, like sports rights. You might say, you know what? Now is not the time for us to invest huge amounts of money for this one market. Maybe we need a partner. And that's my theory anyway. My working theory is better to have an in-country partner who it can help with the management of a product that is going to be driven in part by in-country content. That's my top of my head.
That's probably spot on. I would say that's probably the vast majority. Here's how I kind of view India and then Disney. Or let me reverse that. So Disney, I think, has to make a decision. And I don't think Disney is alone in this. I think I would include Disney. I would include Warner Brothers Discovery, NBC Universal, and potentially Paramount. But who knows what happens to Paramount over the next few months. The question they have to ask is, do I want to be a global DTC player, or do I want to be a global player? And there's a difference there. There's a difference between saying I want to have an owned and operated system, and therefore a team to support that owned and operated system in all these different countries, in every country that I'm launching in. And if I'm doing that, I'm competing with Netflix and Amazon. That's a lot of countries. There are certain countries, and we know this. I think Bob Iger said this on an earnings call a while back, that are more valuable than others. Now, this does not speak to the people. It just speaks to how much money they can make in these. So for example, South Korea, probably arguably more valuable than Indonesia, right? There's just levels of how much can we get in terms of average revenue per user in these territories. So if you're Disney, you need to be global because your content is global. It has the price of a global release. But to Jason's point, you look at India and you say, what advantage do we have in operating here? If our ARPU, which we can see, we could kind of get an idea from Amazon and Netflix, is going to be really low. They almost effectively, and I've been comparing this to like Facebook and Google circa 2013, like they almost have to zero rate the product, right? They almost have to go in and be like, we're going to actually find a way to almost partner with everyone here on the telecom side to like get you to use Netflix for free, like almost, or for like $2 a month. Like you pay very little money and you're going to use it. And then hopefully we get you on and then we can put ads, which reminds me a lot of what Facebook and Google with YouTube did, right? I mean, mm-hmm. like they did that a lot in order to get more people onto the service so they could sell more ads. Disney has no real incentive to do that. Disney just needs its content to perform well within those markets and create adoration so that way if they decide to open a park, theoretically, in India, there's people who want to go. We see this happen in China. We see it happen in Japan. We see it happen in France. So if we reverse that, right? So Disney, we know, needs to be global. So they go theatrical release. They find partners in territories that they want to be in, but they don't want to have owned and operated. Then they have territories that are owned and operated. Then they have territories that they might not even think about, right? Like, we don't necessarily need to be here. We're not really worried about it. We're not missing too much. This is also going to reduce our cost structure because we're not operating here. We're not having to put more people on a customer support line, whatever it is. If we reverse that, why is India important? What is so everyone has brought this up to me. Why does Amazon want to do 69 movies and TV shows in India? Well, think about that. Prime Video is the biggest entry point for Amazon outside of the United States. Like so most people are coming to Amazon internationally via Prime Video. Why? Because the e-commerce structure, think of the entire infrastructure that you have to have a really strong e-commerce business, does not really work in many other countries. But what if you could get it there? So Amazon's big bet is that Prime Video could be a great way to get ads. We get people coming in. Like it could be a strong business for us in general. But also if people adopt Prime Video, if we can create an infrastructure within India that creates an e-commerce business, that's a billion people who might all of a sudden shop on Amazon. That is a huge long-term incentive for Amazon beyond just Prime Video, but Prime Video is your best way in. Netflix's argument is that eventually, as more internet adoption increases, as plans come down, as cable becomes less of a thing in India, which we don't know if it will, but that's their bet, Netflix will be the first ones there, right, with Amazon. So Netflix is arguing that's a billion potential people that we can reach, and that would be huge for us on an ad level, especially in price-conscious territories. Netflix and Amazon have every reason and every incentive structure to say, I will wait in India. We'll figure out a way to do it. Disney doesn't. Also, Netflix and Amazon have how much in free cash flow, right? They can't. Mm-hmm. They can be like, all right, we're going to wait it out a little bit longer. If Apple wanted to, they could too. Disney doesn't have that. Paramount doesn't have that. Paramount just right. sold its Viacom 18 stake, right? Like the WBD doesn't have that for sure. And NBC Uni could, but I don't think they're interested. So for them, it's easier to say, okay, we'll find a way to license to local partners in India where we can actually just generate revenue and not have to worry about operation here,
right.
Not have to worry about working with the government in any capacity. That's something that Netflix and Amazon have to worry about. So all of these different – not worry about the fact that I think there's – and please correct me if I'm wrong here, listeners. I think there's four dominant languages within India, like or versions of their main language, but like, so not have to worry about, okay, well, which pocket do we release this film in order to reach the biggest audience? There's no incentive structure for Disney. The biggest incentive structure is there's a billion people who might like our product. We could maybe put a park there, but it's still a price. It's a price conscious or cost conscious territory. But if people really like Finding Nemo, that was an old movie, or Inside Out 2, or the Guardians of the Galaxy, they'll go watch it. And then if they go watch it and they make enough money in theaters, then in our pay one deal with a local partner, we're going to generate more revenue anyways. And we can sell more merch. We can sell more plushies. That's the Disney right. business through and through. Right. And
you,
so I just
Do you have think, to be in managing a business in
right.
every territory? That doesn't mean that there aren't territories that are worth it for you to manage. But do you have to be this struck me because you mentioned in passing Paramount, right? When they're in big trouble and going to get sold and who knows what's going to happen there. But as a Star Trek fan, I'll just say I find it very funny that they started by saying, oh, globally, we're going to be on Netflix or globally, we're going to be on Prime Video. And then they're like, no, we're pulling it off and we're going to launch Paramount Plus in Europe. It's like, do you really need to do that? Or could you just sell Star Trek to someone in Europe who has a product that could use Star Trek and you get money and you don't have to manage, you don't have to spend all the money to launch a European streaming channel? Like, do you need to do that? Or would it be better to license in that market? And does not everybody, it's funny because 2 years ago, we might have said something different here, but like not every streaming product needs to be global, right? Not everybody needs to be Netflix. Some some need to be more global than others, arguably, but like certainly beyond just the question of do you want to be a content arms dealer or not, there's the question of like, do you want to have a direct-to-consumer product in every country, or do you really not need that?
Well, and I think that's exactly it. And I think if we look at Netflix, right, so this stuff almost goes back to the theatrical conversation. What incentive structure do the traditional studios have for going to theaters? Typically, and we know this from data, theatrical makes bigger films. That's really important for box office revenue, sure, but you're still splitting that about 65-45, right? Like, it's still a pretty decent cut that goes to the exhibitors. Then you take into account marketing costs and P&A costs. Like, it's just nightmare. But they make a lot of money in the movie theaters, and then when you sell as a package to HBO or Netflix or whatever, your pay one is much higher. It's why Sony did that $1 billion pay one deal with Netflix. And that could increase depending on how much money those movies make in theaters. If you don't have that, right, why be in theaters? And we've had this conversation. Mm-hmm. So think about that from the DTC side. All of these companies have other revenue incentive structures to say like, oh, okay, well, we just don't have to be in that country. We can license. Netflix's whole thing is we are a DTC platform. We make our money by having more consumers come in and pay us directly and then put advertisements on it. Now, could Netflix start licensing its content in India to other players? Sure, but how much content is there that Netflix really has to give away? Disney has 40, 50, 60 years of catalog. So do the other companies. And they've got 30 new shows every year, especially on the broadcasting side, or not 30, but, you know, closer to 15, 20 now, that actually do resonate really well because they follow certain formats, their procedurals, or whatever they may be. Those tend to do well overseas. Netflix has very specific high premium dramas. Not to say that they don't do well overseas. They're the most global entertainment company from a television perspective and probably arguably from film, getting close to it. But it doesn't have that same level of value. There's not that same level of brand. And so I think for Netflix, the goal is, okay, well, we assume that at some point a country like India becomes very online. They already are, right? They're heavy social media users. They use YouTube a lot. They love YouTube a lot. They have DTC local platforms that they pay for. And Netflix is hoping that eventually they can become a dominant form of entertainment within that country. They can generate more advertising via revenue because as they bring more consumers on, they can sell that. They can sell ads there. All of these different things. There is a huge incentive structure for Netflix, and I would argue there's a massive disincentive structure for everyone else who's already looking at the cost of streaming, regretting how fast they moved into it, regretting the pricing that they've set. And you're at a point now where they're saying, we're not just going to cowboy it up anymore. That's what we did before, and we got killed for it from the street. And so what we need to do now is kind of pull back and say, well, what do we really need to do, and what do we not need to do? And that incentive versus disincentive structure is going to be the key thing that plays out amongst all of these different types of companies.
All right. We'll keep an eye on it. Thank you to Sarva for writing in from India to remind us about that. Now, before we go, real quick, Sports Corner.
Sports Corner.
It's just we got to be fast because we're almost at the end. Because, again, as I said at the beginning, we could talk about there's no such thing as a short episode of Drownstream because you and I could talk forever about this stuff. Sports Corner, two items. Item one, NFL announced two streaming NFL exclusives for the coming season. September 6th, there will be a regular season game on Peacock. It's the Brazil game. So I think it's a different time slot, but Peacock is going to get a streaming only game. And Peacock, which had a streaming only playoff game last year, this year, Prime Video will have the streaming only playoff game. So that they're not making another playoff game streaming only. That fourth wild card game will be on Prime Video instead of Peacock this time. And I just thought we should, at the very least, note it. I definitely some people have used this to talk about Spulu and the idea of like, well, yeah, okay, so you get sport, you pay for Spulu for whatever that is, maybe cheaper than something like Fubo or YouTube TV. But if you want to watch that game, you got to pay for Peacock. And if you want to watch that playoff game, you got to pay for Prime Video. So you're rebuilding, you know, even Spulu doesn't rebuild your bundle so that you get everything. You still have to pay more. And of course it doesn't. Of course it doesn't. Unless they bundle Peacock with it too, but they don't want to. So anyway, Anyway, that's where we are.
My only hot take on this, and it's not a hot take at all, is that it just reiterates the lack of potential I see in Spulu.
Yeah.
That's my only take.
Yeah. The truth is, it's not a gotcha. It's like literally, well, if NBC Universal's not in Spulu, then you also have to add in the pay paying for Peacock is part of what is going to get you all your sports.
Exactly.
You got to keep adding it all back in. It's not a one-stop shop. It's a part of a larger bundle that you will have to assemble yourself. And it's just, nobody should think of Spulu as a solution to all sports. Now, ESPN. So speaking of Spulu, this is an interesting little tiny detail. And so it's here at the end of Downstream, here at the end of Sports Corner. But I think it's interesting based on things that we've been talking about
yep.
potential for aggregators of sports, whether it's ESPN or Apple or whoever, but ESPN, great brand for it. ESPN has integrated regional sports networks into its main app and website. Now, this is interesting because it's geo-targeted because these are regional sports apps. But basically, if you go to the ESPN app and you're in Boston and the Red Sox are playing, NESN is listed and there's a link to NESN saying, here is where the Red Sox game is in the scoreboard, and you tap and it will go to the NESN website or open the NESN app. Likewise, in the D.C. area, Monumental Sports Network, and in Pittsburgh, Sportsnet Pittsburgh has this deal. ESPN does not have rights to these things. They are doing geo-targeted links to separate telecasts. But what it does do is it's a little toe in the water of ESPN saying, you know what? ESPN is here for you to let you know how you can watch that sporting event, wherever it is. So come to us, and we may have it. And if we don't, we know where it is. And I'll grant you, we know where it is for three RSNs. But I think this is really interesting because it goes back to what you and I talked about a few weeks ago, which is, you know what might be valuable, even if you don't have all the sports rights, is being a sports portal, because then everybody will just use you to find out where the sports are. And that is powerful. And ESPN is the perfect brand for it. So it's interesting that they're experimenting with this, I thought.
Yeah, I have nothing more to add to that other than we've been saying on this podcast for a while that this was the inevitable race. It's also an you can use a favorite term for a lot of people. It's you can throw some display ads. Remember display ads? Yeah. Remember when that was like the height of like the hype?
Good times.
Great times. So you can throw some display ads on top of that. And I think the real winner in that, I think, is still somehow going to be Amazon, because I think they have the channel structure built in so well.
Sure.
And they get right. And it's unified and payment system.
And they have a hardware platform, right? I mean, I'm sure Apple platform. Will do it. I'm sure Roku yeah. will do yeah. it. But like Amazon has some great advantages in that they have yes. apps on all the players, and they have a hardware platform, and they have the channel structure. I'm sure Apple yeah. will do a bespoke version of it too. I did that interview. I got to talk to Eddie Q about their sports app a few weeks ago. And like, I mean, Apple's going to do it in some form, but it's going to be within on their own terms in their own ecosystem. But like for the general public, like, yeah, Amazon's gonna play it. And I think ESPN, I think that this is the new era where the benefit may be advertising. It may also be selling channels. I mean, we talk about Spulu, yeah. but just the ideal of who's to say that in the end, ESPN won't also offer you a referral to Peacock to watch that, or to some other kind of service. And they get to promote their own sports in that interface as well, because they get that's the beauty of it. They're aggregating everything, but they're promoting the stuff that they own. And if they can train you to come there, even if it's not on ESPN, boy, that is a major asset. That's a big advantage for them. So I love this little tiny detail spotted by a few people, written about at Deadline.com. Clever, just clever. All right. We're going to go. This is the end of this episode. We'll be back in probably about a week, because we are late with this episode.
I'm sorry.
We do have a request. So we loved hearing from Sarva today. Downstreamfeedback.com. If you have questions or comments, love to your mothers. We love to hear it. And we're going to make a request, which is streaming advice. Maybe making this a new segment, little quick thing. Do you, listeners, have advice for us about what to watch or what services we should sign up for? Some recommendations for us. We'd like to hear from you. We talk a lot on this podcast. You can't talk except through downstreamfeedback.com, but tell us. Recommend things for us. We'll see how that goes, right? We'll just see.
Yes, please.
We'll see what happens. Trust us, we subscribe to everything, but maybe not. Maybe not. If it's a show, a movie, a sport, a niche service, whatever. I would love to hear about it and why. And we'll share some of those on the podcast.
Tell me why I should pay for Paramount Plus again. Jason's going to say Star Trek.
Star Trek's coming back in a few weeks. But yeah, I know, right? This is like why should I pay for Stars? It's like, well, because eventually Outlander will be back. But that's about it. All right. So do it. Downstreamfeedback.com. We would love to hear from you. You can find Julia at parrotanalytics.com and at puck.news. And if you're very lucky, on her calendar, which is triple booked 24 hours a day, she's very busy. You can find me at sixcolors.com. Boy, I'm free the rest of the afternoon. And I appear on many other podcasts at Relay FM and theincomparable.com. That brings us to the end. But until next time, maybe even next week, Julia, say goodbye.
Oh my God, we did this in under 60 minutes. Goodbye. I'm so proud of us.
I am too. Oh, the taxis outside are proud of us. The honking, the sirens are proud of us. They're all proud of us.
Bye, guys.